MacCast, Thursday, September 8th, 2011. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. You know, it's been a strange couple weeks in Apple news. Everything's in kind of a holding pattern, a lull, as we wait for Apple to make a move, make an announcement, actually invite the press. This should be the very next thing that they do, to their special event where they're going to show off, hopefully, the iPhone 5. Well, I'm fairly certain at this point it's going to be the iPhone 5, iOS 5, maybe some new iPod touches, stuff like that. We're going to be talking about that in this episode. Apple's continuing bouts with Samsung. Also, maybe some information coming out on the next generation iPad 3 designs. Thunderbolt getting ready to actually take off. And then, of course, your feedback, a bunch of other things to talk about. We'll be talking a lot about Linux and terminal stuff in this episode. So we're going to get a little more geeky this time around on the MacCast. So stay tuned for all of that. Before we get into things, though, I want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, Gazelle. You know, I mentioned we're expecting new iPods, new iPhones sometime in the very near future, so it might be a good time to get familiar with Gazelle. If you're not, you can go over to gazelle.com and check it out. They call themselves a re-commerce service. So they do recycling, but what they start to do is try and actually reuse the products that they purchase from you. And so if you need to get cash for some old electronics, it could be an iPhone, an iPod, even something like a digital camera, video camera, anything you have lying around in the drawer or the back of the closet, just pull it out, get the model number, information, condition, and then go over to gazelle.com and do a search. They have a huge database of products that they keep track of. And you just answer some questions about the condition, the accessories, and things that you have, and they will give you an offer right there on the screen, tell you how much they'd give you for that product. For anything that isn't of value, they can handle the recycling for you if you'd like them to do that. And they do it responsibly using certified and accredited partners. So you can find all the information on that part of their service on their website. But on the items of value, they'll often send you a box and even pay for the shipping. And what's great, too, is if you want to keep track, they kind of have this trending chart of what the recent offers have been. So you can kind of see how the price is going, whether it's going up or down, and keep an eye on that. You might want to do that as we get closer to the launch of the iPhone and try and time when you might get the best offer for your item. So you can find all that information over at gazelle.com. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. I have to be honest, Apple's relationship with Samsung is something recently that's been very puzzling to me, because on the one side, we have Samsung providing Apple with a lot of technology that goes into making their products, specifically their iOS devices, the iPhone, the iPad. The A4 chips are produced by Samsung. A lot of the, or if not all, the flash memory and flash RAM that goes into the products is supplied by Samsung. Apple shored up that relationship very early on. And so you have that going on. And then on the flip side of it, you have all of these lawsuits that Apple keeps filing, and more specifically, these injunctions to stop Samsung from selling their Galaxy Tab line of products and their smartphones in different markets. The opening battlefield for all this has been Germany, and Apple won a new preliminary injunction this week against Samsung in Germany, causing them to halt sales of the Galaxy Tab 7. They were getting ready for an expo there. They were going to have some product out on the show floor at this IFA show in Berlin. They had to pull that stuff. They've replaced it with other things. They had to cover up signage and block out stuff. So it's not looking good for Samsung in Germany. Apple's also been assaulting them in Australia. And there's a judge in Australia that now wants Apple to provide some sales numbers to show that they've actually been impacted by Samsung's products in that market. Apple isn't required to, although I think the quote that I read was that the judge is strongly encouraging Apple to provide those numbers, and we'll have to see if Apple actually comes forward with that. My guess is they're not going to unless they're actually required. And the thing is that even without these injunctions, And I guess this is the frustrating part for me on the patent front. Even without these injunctions, Apple is no doubt very successful. And I think that's the point this Australian judge is trying to show, is that the competitors aren't even making headway. On the 7-inch tablet front, I find it interesting because Steve Jobs himself, in a quarterly conference call, called the sub 10-inch tablets non-starters. He said these things aren't even competitive. They're not going to be a problem. All of our competitors are going to have to move to 7-inch tablets. We know that's not going to be the case. But Apple also needs to aggressively protect its patents. So I understand they've got patents on tablet designs, the design patents. And as I was doing some research to try and just gain better understanding and understand a little bit about patents, and let me be the first to tell you right now, this stuff completely confuses me. So if you're a patent attorney and a patent lawyer and you can chime in with some explanation on how all this stuff works, by all means. But what I was able to discover is that historically, design patents aren't very strong, but they're something that can round out a company's patent portfolio and help them with protections for things like utility patents and other patents that cover a lot of the innovations and designs that go into the product technology. There's also some overlap with, and I think this also causes confusion, with copyright patents. So a lot of design elements specifically related to software design and UI design, but also just product design, can be covered in addition by copyright as well as design patents. And so you have all this going on, and it starts to me to feel like we're losing sight of innovation, that there becomes this fine line that ends up being ridden between sort of protecting your products and your patents and your designs from just being blatantly copied, and then just completely stifling innovation or causing an anti-competitive marketplace. So if Apple's able to go out and just completely block all of their competition in all of these markets, well, then there's no competition. And I think that stifles not only Apple's competitors, but also Apple's innovation. If they're not pushed to continue to make great products, and I guess they have internal drive to do that, but if you're not pushed by competitors, if you're the dominant player in a market, then internally you become stagnant. And I think you can look at Microsoft as maybe an example of that in the software market, and look where they are now. They're kind of floundering and searching for direction. And I think, you know, that comes from sort of this, I hate to say monopoly, but you create this monopoly situation to a certain degree. And so it's been frustrating for me to kind of watch this stuff. Apple is, I think, right in a lot of areas when it comes to this. If you start looking at Samsung's products, and I started to do that this week as well, they are really blatantly copying a lot of the designs. You look at the products, and I'm not talking about just the tablet form factors, but we can't even go into that. I was having a conversation with Jeff Gamet about this, and I think he's got an absolute correct point. If you look at smartphones before the iPhone, they look very different than they do today. And almost every smartphone with a touchscreen that you look at now looks like an iPhone. And the same thing can be said for these tablets. And so that's why I think Apple is so aggressively trying to shut down these competitors in these markets. And they've decided to start, it seems like, with Samsung. Probably because Samsung, I think, is one of the more successful competitors, and also probably one of the most blatant copiers in terms of the design. And they had access to a lot of Apple's early designs, I'm sure, through their relationship. So that has to probably add insult to injury from Apple's standpoint. And I was looking at things like all the way down to the connector that they use, that Samsung used for their tablets, looks like a 30-pin dock connector. I think if you casually asked someone to take a look at that connection and how it worked, they would not be able to distinguish that design from Apple's design. They had a dock adapter, a USB dock adapter, that was on Samsung's website that, to me, looked like a black version of Apple's camera connection kit, USB dock connector. I probably, if you had asked me and it didn't say Samsung on it, I probably couldn't tell the difference. I go, oh, that's a black version of Apple's camera connection kit. Cool. So when you start seeing those things, you really start to understand where, you know, Apple might be coming from. And I'm trying to gain a better understanding because I've been kind of adamant against patent and kind of pro-patent law changes. And I think we're going to get some of those. I think the more egregious problem in the States, at least, and probably internationally, is on the software side, where you have things like one-click buttons able to be patented and stuff like that. I think a lot of UI design should just be covered by the existing copyright laws. But again, it's something I'm going to have to delve into and educate myself on a little bit more. I think a lot of us, and I'm guilty of this for sure, are quick to rush to judgment based on just stuff that we read here and there. And I, for one, am trying to dig a little deeper and gain a better understanding of this. So if you can share your insights, if you have some experience in this area, especially those of you who are in patent law and stuff like that, I'd love to have you submit some feedback and kind of educate us on this stuff. But I do worry in the back of my mind about it stifling innovation and competition, and I want that to continue. But at the same time, I understand Apple's need to be able to protect its products and not just have sort of blatant ripoffs of their design going on. I'm going to give you one more example, because I was looking at, and this is more on the UI side, on the software side. I was looking at one of the product shots of Samsung's 8.9 Galaxy Tab, and it's running the new Honeycomb OS from Google, from Android. And in this case, I think it's more the OS infringing, but you never really know that, because since Honeycomb or since Android is open source, each manufacturer can kind of tweak the design of the UI. But one of the pictures, it looked like there was a dock, you know, the 3D, the shelf with the icons sitting on top of it. And it turned out just to be the background desktop, I think, that they were using. But they do line up a number of the application icons right along the bottom edge of the screen, and that makes it look like a dock. And so you're a judge, and you're looking at this case, and you're looking at these product shots, and you're going, well, that looks just like an iPad. That UI design looks the same. There were some music player icons, application icons, that looked just like the iTunes icon. I would say they were almost just directly copied down to the color. They would think it was purple in color, which is a color Apple used to use back in the day for iTunes, but might even be exactly the same color purple. It's really hard to tell from some of the screenshots. So I think it's those sorts of things that are causing a lot of this uproar and upheaval. And I'm starting to come around and kind of completely understand this stuff. But I think we definitely need to have more conversation about this and try and gain an understanding on all sides of the equation. But I certainly now kind of understand why Apple's beef is with Samsung first and foremost, because certainly there's something going on there. Apple made a move this week that kind of made it seem like they backpedaled a little bit on their decisions surrounding what direction they were moving in with Final Cut Pro. They resurrected Final Cut Pro Studio sales, at least to a certain degree. They've made it so that if you want to buy Final Cut Studio 7, you can call in on Apple's online sales number at 1-800-MY-APPLE, and you can still purchase the product. It's still priced at $999 US, so far above the $299 price that you can get for Final Cut Pro 10 on the App Store. But it kind of makes it seem like they're giving in a little bit to the professional video editing community, who caused a little bit of an uproar. If you go back and listen to my episode on that, I think you can kind of gain an understanding of why video editors were so upset. But basically, Apple dropped what many considered a lot of key features from the product. Specifically, I think one of the biggest ones was the fact that you couldn't take your Final Cut Pro 7 projects and import them into Final Cut Pro 10. Also, additional things like there was no support for output to tape, which some video editors still rely on. Also, no XML export, no OMF export for mixing your audio in Pro Tools, kind of round-tripping stuff like that. And there were a lot of other complaints of other missing features or hobbled features from the Pro community. The big thing that the Pro community wanted out of Final Cut Pro 10 was 64-bit support, and that was added, but many considered the radical new interface and design changes of the product to kind of make it so almost like it wasn't a Pro product anymore, basically. That it was really something targeted at sort of the prosumer, pro hobbyist, and Apple didn't bring along what everybody was looking for. So it seems like they've put it back on sale so that those video editors who depend on Final Cut Pro 7 can still get new copies. They can still buy additional licenses for maybe new employees they bring on board as they staff up and things like that. But it may be too late, because according to The Loop this week, Adobe's video editing tools have jumped up in sales 22% year over year. So a lot of the pro editors might be looking for a different tool and might be turning to the Adobe Premiere Pro products as the solution moving forward, at least in the high-end professional end of the market. So we'll have to see how it goes for Apple. I think I mentioned in that episode that really Apple is doing a reboot of the Final Cut Pro product, much in the same way that they did with iMovie when they changed it from iMovie HD to the new version of iMovie that's in the iLife suite. It took them a couple versions to get it, or to get people to kind of convert over and understand the new methodology, the new way of editing, the new user interface. But I think in the end, it's a much cooler product if you've played around with it. I love the new iMovie, and I kind of railed against the existing version. So I was always in that consumer space. And I think we're seeing a similar thing go on in the pro market. Apple's already said that a lot of the features that were quote unquote hobbled or removed, a lot of those are going to be coming back in future versions. But I think Apple needs to build up a new code base and a new version of the product. The question remains is, are pro video editors going to wait around long enough? Or does it even matter? Is Apple going to get a whole new crop of customers and consumers who really like the new Final Cut Pro 10 methodology, and that will slowly move up and Apple will build something new moving forward, leaving competitors like Adobe behind because everybody's going to want to use the new systems rather than the old ones? And Apple's classically done that. So we'll have to see if they can make that work for them again. But I have a feeling based on history that that will eventually kind of work out. I think we're getting to that point where we are no longer going to have iPhone rumors to talk about, but iPhone facts. At least I'm really hoping so. Things are certainly heating up and looking like an imminent iPhone launch announcement event is going to take place. Deutsche Telekom started taking pre-orders already for the iPhone 5 with no information, no release date or anything like that. They're just saying, hey, we want to better manage demand. We want to know how much demand we're actually going to have. So you can say you want an iPhone 5 and they'll tell you later when you're actually going to be able to purchase it. We did get some more details about potential tech specs this week. Rumors pointed to at least two suppliers for the iPhone 5 camera sensors, Largon Precision and Genus Electronic Optical, which makes sense because those are the current suppliers for the iPhone 4 sensors. It is expected that it will be an 8-megapixel sensor on the back, and we might have seen an actual image off that sensor this week. This was first reported by Pocket Now. There was an image of sushi on a Flickr account for an Apple developer, and the EXIF data, when they looked into it, showed that it was an iPhone 4, but the resolution didn't quite line up. It showed an original resolution of 3264 by 2448. And if you do the math on that, that makes it almost an 8-megapixel image. It was actually cropped down to 2235 by 2291, about 5 megapixels. But the lens information also indicated a different lens, showing a 4.3mm f2.4 lens versus the 3.85mm f2.8 lens, which is on the current generation iPhone 4. And then to further kind of prop up the rumor and add credence to it, the image was pulled once it was discovered from the account, or I think it was actually made private not long after the rumor reports kind of leaked out. So I think that probably is the case. It's going to be an 8-megapixel sensor. As far as other design changes, we're hearing and getting information based on leaked case designs out of China, which you got to take these with a grain of salt. They tend to be reliable or have been reliable in the past, but a lot of it ends up being off of just speculation and other rumors, so you never really know for sure. It's looking, though, like we're going to get a thinner design, slightly wider curved edges, and it may be slightly wider to accommodate a larger screen. We're hearing screen sizes ranging from 3.5 inch, which is the current screen size, all the way up to 4 inches. I think it's going to land somewhere in the middle, right around 3.7 inches. PhotoStream icon showed up in some of the Apple developer stuff, and I believe 9 to 5 Mac did a little bit of scaling and adjustment on the icon, and it seemed to indicate a 3.7 inch screen size. It was also slightly taller, which meant the area for the home button had to be squished or condensed a little bit, and consequently the home button sort of was cropped. It had the tops and bottoms cropped off, so it was flat on top and bottom and then rounded on either side, and that matches up with some of the case designs that we've seen, although many people had thought it was more rectangular, elongated area for the home button, lending credence to the fact that it might be a touch-sensitive area, a new touch-sensitive area in the area of the home screen. The 9 to 5 reports seem to indicate that the home button is still the same width, just cropped on the top and bottom. So that's likely still just a button, and I tend to believe that too. I don't think Apple's doing anything touch-sensitive-wide in that area, but you know, I could be wrong. That's just my pure speculation. Also, most people expect it to be a world phone, a single chipset that will accommodate multiple carriers. I think that will be the case. 9 to 5 also reports that a special version of iOS 5 was released to carriers recently, enabling Nuance speech-to-text technology and FaceTime over 3G so they can start testing out their carrier networks. It's commonly believe that if Apple does integrate the Nuance technology, it's going to use the server-side technology, so it will need to function over 3G to send your voice commands over for processing and then kick that back to the phone. So that all makes sense. It is a special build that developers don't have access to yet. And you remember those N94 iPhone 4S rumors? Well, those continue to prevail as well. Supposedly, we saw a new FCC ID number in the wild in iOS 5 beta 7 that would indicate that version of a phone. I still am having a hard time believing that Apple will do an iPhone 5 and an iPhone 4S model. I think everything that we're seeing indicates iPhone 5. As far as the release time schedule, 9 to 5 and Cult2Mac put out, I think, what is a pretty accurate map of what we can expect in the coming weeks in terms of Apple's announcements, events, and launch dates. So they're saying September 14th, next week, we'll see press invites going out. That's typically 1 week before Apple actually holds the event, meaning that the event would occur on September 21st, then followed by Apple taking pre-orders for the iPhone 5 on September 28th, about 9 days before the actual release, with the release date being on October 7th. And we've seen several indicators that back up the October 7th release date for the iPhone 5, including some internal memo leaks from Best Buy and Sprint. And also, I believe, early October was the date thrown out by All Things Digital and some other publications that I put a lot of credence and legitimacy behind. So I think that's going to line up quite nicely. And also backing up the October, early October release timeframe is the fact that the iOS beta builds expire on October 20th. So all the stars are aligning for, I think, an October release of the iPhone 5. There's also indications that we'll see new iPod touches at that event. Apple has historically released new versions of the iPods, iTunes, and stuff like that in that September-October timeframe. As far as what we'll see in new models, potentially a new white model of the iPod Touch. That's based on some images and parts that have been surfacing recently. And also that Apple will be adding 3G support to those models. I think the 3G rumor has a lot of credence, basically because we have 3G versions of the iPads. And I think extending that to an iPod Touch is a natural extension, especially when you consider some of the features that are in the new version of iOS 5, specifically iMessage, which will allow you to send messages for free between iOS devices. And I think Apple's going to want to have as many of those devices out there on the market. So this is a really cool thing, especially if you're a parent and you're looking for a less expensive alternative to an SMS messaging plan, maybe for your teen. You would have the potential to get them an iPod Touch, throw in a 3G messaging plan at maybe a more affordable rate. They'll be able to get their SMS messages, and then it'll automatically flip over to using the iMessage service if their friend has an iPad, an iPod Touch, or an iPhone, thus saving you a lot of money. And I think that is going to be a welcome update in the face of carriers like AT&T forcing us on to higher rate messaging plans and sort of cutting that back. The two things may be related, actually. With iMessage coming on board, the carriers might be looking to sort of salvage some of their SMS money, but I think Apple's got out ahead of them in terms of what it's doing with messaging, and extending that to the iPod Touch is only going to help further that initiative. So I'm getting very excited about the new products, the new announcements. It's going to be fun to be able to start talking about the actual things rather than just rumors, and then getting ready for when we're going to be in line at our Apple store to pick up our new iPhone 5s. So I'm getting excited. I'm sure you are too. And naturally, as we bring one set of rumors to a close, we have to move on to the next thing. And the next thing, of course, is the iPad 3. We've already had some iPad 3 rumors, but this week we got a couple more. Taiwan Economic News says Simplo Technology and Dynapack International are going to make a new battery for the iPad 3, allowing it to be thinner, safer, and offer a longer battery life. It's going to up the component costs for Apple about 20 or 30%, but I think that's to be expected. Another component that is supposed to get a really nice upgrade would be the processor. Apple moving to an A6 chip in the next generation device, switching their manufacturer for the processor away from Samsung over to Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing. This week, the head of research for that company said that their 28 nanometer technology is ready. They've filled all their orders to capacity, and it's just, the assumption is that all those orders are actually Apple, and that they will be going into mass production in early 2012, which lines up right with the time frame. There had been some reports that the A6 potentially could be a quad-core processor, but I do think that it's going to remain dual-core. I think mainly for power and battery life reasons. I'm sure we'll get a nice little clock speed bump in there, maybe 1.2, 1.4, 1.6 gigahertz on the dual core side. But that's just, again, my speculation. I haven't seen any of those numbers reported. As far as why I think Apple's sticking on the yearly release cycle rather than rushing something out in the fall, if you remember earlier in the year, there was a lot of speculation and reports that Apple might put out a iPad 2.5, something with a higher res screen. I still think you can look at Apple's sales numbers on the iPad 2 and see that they don't need to rush something to market. There's not a lot of competition. They're still dominating in the field. Foxconn will reportedly have shipped 20 million iPad 2s to Apple by the end of this summer. That's a 60% increase over their spring shipments. So lots of iPad 2s selling through the holiday season, and then Apple can release their new version when things start to calm down, maybe in the first quarter of next year. As far as iPhone sales predictions for 2012, we saw some interesting numbers from DigiTimes. They're saying that Apple will have shipped 86.4 million units, and that Foxconn is going to be shipping 5 to 6 million iPhone 5s just this month, with up to 22 million by the end of the year. So iPhone 5 sales are looking to be very, very brisk, which may go back to why, as I mentioned earlier, over there in Germany, they're already taking pre-orders. They're just trying to get a feel for how many iPhone 5s they're going to need to keep the supply chain healthy. And as far as the future goes for Apple, well, by 2013, how many iOS devices will Apple sell? A metric crud load. And if you want to know how much a crud load is, according to Gene Munster, that's 143 million iPhones and 68 million iPads by 2013. So Apple showing no signs of slowing down in terms of their iOS devices. It's going to be the dominant portion of their business, at least into the near future. Two-thirds, possibly more, as we move forward, I guess, until Apple comes up with the next great device. And we're going to have to stay tuned to see what that actually is. They're probably going to have to unseat their own product success with their own devices to actually make a change. I don't see any of the competition coming up anytime soon. With the release of iOS 5 getting closer, it also means that the iCloud is looming. Apple pushed macOS 10.7.2 and the 10th beta of the iCloud service out to developers. Developers have also been recently given new builds of the iWork suite that work along with iCloud. And in this latest update, Apple also opened up their new iTunes Match service, which is the $25 a year paid for service. They made that available to developers to start testing. Developers did have to pay to get in on that. and it filled up pretty quickly. It looks like it was a limited beta release, and just the first few developers, or the first round of developers that signed up on almost launch day, were able to get in. Those that were able to start playing around with it quickly noted that it seemed like the service was allowing streaming, because once you ran it, matched up the songs in your iTunes library with what Apple had up in the cloud, you could, from any iOS device, start almost instantly playing the track. And what turned out was actually really happening is that it is a progressive download. So you can actually start playing the track as it's downloading, but it then does actually download to your device. There is really no true streaming component, not like you would have in Pandora or something like that. So if you had read some reports that streaming was enabled through the iTunes Match, that's not technically the case, although it can really feel like that. So I can completely understand where some of the confusion might have come from. And also, I read some of the reports that were saying that it was streaming, but then Apple changed something. But Apple's own spokespeople just came out and said, no, it's not a streaming service. It is a pure sync download service, and that's just how it is designed to work, and that's how it will work. So when it is finally made available to the rest of us, that's what you can expect. If you remember earlier this year, Apple generated a lot of excitement and hype when it announced Thunderbolt, its new connector for hooking up high-speed external devices to your Mac, also your displays via the mini display port. Well, actually, now the Thunderbolt connector, right? They renamed the whole thing. It was originally what was called Lightpeak, a technology developed by Intel. That was the code name for it. Apple's marketing name for it is Thunderbolt. And Thunderbolt actually is the combining of the Lightpeak technology along with the mini display port technology. So you have the one connector for hooking up all of your peripherals, be it, you know, high-speed video stuff or external hard drives, RAIDs, and what have you. And Intel made its Thunderbolt development kit available to third parties, actually, in the first quarter of this year, too. But a lot of it kind of fell flat since there wasn't a whole bunch of devices or peripherals that you could hook up to your Thunderbolt port. Well, I think that's going to be changing relatively soon. We got rumors this week that Apple's Thunderbolt LCD displays are now shipping to Apple retail stores, so those should be on the store shelves, and people should be receiving their shipments if they pre-ordered them, or we should start to hear about that now. I also expect that we'll see a whole slew of new products hitting the market. What's great about Thunderbolt is that it's in essence an external connector for PCI, for PCI Express. So you can kind of think about it like anything that you could have a PCI card for historically. So if you had that Mac Pro Tower with your PCI slots, anything that you could have connected into that port can now exist as an external device. And then Apple also worked with Intel to add on the DisplayPort technology so that it can drive external displays. But we're going to see all these products come out, all kinds of adapters and things like that. I've had a lot of people ask me about, will Apple ever support USB 3 or have USB 3 ports in Macs? And actually, there were some rumors this week saying that Apple is considering adding USB 3 to Macs in the future, despite the fact that Intel's not really supporting it on their controller chips moving forward. Thing is with mini display, or excuse me, with Thunderbolt, you really don't need that, because you could have adapters that could do USB 3, FireWire 400, FireWire 800, and any other new interface that might come along, because it, like I said, it would be just like plugging in a PCI card. So if you have a USB 3 PCI card, then you could do the same thing through a Thunderbolt port. And we're even seeing a number of breakout products come out. One was announced this week that is a breakout box, hooks to your Mac via the Thunderbolt port, but then is an external case with three built-in PCI slots. You can just drop PCI cards in there. So if you want to have a really high-end graphics card, put that in the breakout box, hook it up on your Thunderbolt chain, and away you go. You can drive all of those peripherals through that single port. So as these new devices come out, and I think we're going to see a lot of them coming out now, you're going to really see how versatile it is. And so when I think about new Macs moving forward, I think we're going to see more of Apple consolidating down to just the Thunderbolt ports and leaving off some of the other ones. They could potentially get rid of USB altogether, although I think the rumors are coming about because if Apple does replace USB at some point, the natural progression would be to move to a USB 3 connector. But they could go Thunderbolt all the way. Whether they will or not, I'm kind of iffy on. I'm not saying that they will. I'm not saying that they won't. But it wouldn't surprise me if it moved in that direction. And if you want to know more about Thunderbolt, I did cover it in a MacCast member episode. That's episode 83, and you can get that by becoming a MacCast member. You can find more information and details on that at member.maccast.com. And that's going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I want to take a quick moment, thank another one of my show sponsors, Phoronix, makers of Deep Freeze. Deep Freeze is a great product you can use to reduce your IT and computer management costs. And right now, since it's back to school time, if you're a teacher, you're an educator, you're an administrator, and you're responsible for setting up computers in labs or working with computers in the classroom, it's great because you want to spend time teaching and not worrying about what your students are downloading or potentially installing on your computers. And Deep Freeze can help you manage that. What I like about Deep Freeze is that it doesn't restrict users, though, when they're actually using the system. So it's not the kind of thing where everything is locked down in such a way where you're constantly getting pop-ups and it's saying, you can't do this, you can't do that. Your users can have free, unrestricted access to the system during a session, but what happens is when they're done, you simply reboot that system, and then any of the frozen or protected areas that you've defined will be restored back to their original state. Data in the thawed spaces stays there and is there the next time the users come back to use that system. It's great from a management perspective too, because it has support for remote management tools like Apple's Remote Desktop, and you can set up entire sessions where the system is thawed if you need to do application installs, software updates, and that sort of thing. And they're really on top of their Mac support. They are already Lion compatible, so if you're planning an upgrade, you already have done your upgrade and you're looking to use Deep Freeze, it's ready to go. It's ready for you to install and deploy into your environment. So you can check it out, get more information and details as well as trials over at Phoronix.com. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. On the last episode of the MacCast, I covered some Lion things, some Lion updates. And one of the big new features that I covered that I was kind of excited about was the new move option when you're using keyboard shortcuts to copy and now move, not just paste items in the Finder. So you can press Command Option V instead of Command V, the traditional paste command. If you hold down the Option key in addition, you end up moving the file rather than actually just copying it or making a copy of it. And that works internally on a single volume and between volumes as well. Well, a number of you emailed to let me know that you could move files using Snow Leopard in earlier versions of the Mac OS X. You just had to do it through a drag and drop operation. And this kind of illustrates a little bit of my point and why I was kind of excited about this feature coming to Lion is the fact that I think I knew this feature was there, but I always tended to forget about it. And Michael and several others pointed out that if you simply hold down the Command key when dragging and dropping a file between volumes, it executes a move command just like it would in Lion if you were using the keyboard shortcuts. I think the big key difference is that in the earlier versions, I don't believe, I'm probably going to get myself in trouble again, but I'm pretty sure there's not a way to do it simply with keyboard shortcuts. I used to do it through using other programs like Pathfinder or just through terminal commands, and now I can do it natively in Mac OS X Lion all from the keyboard. But everybody is right. In earlier versions, if you do the drag and drop method holding down the Command key, that will work for moving a file between volumes. Another thing that came up on the last MacCast is somebody had sent me a link to a 60 Minutes interview that they had done with Steve Jobs, I think from a few years back, and they were kind of asking him about how he managed Apple or, you know, how he worked. And he referenced the Beatles as kind of an inspiration for how he liked to manage things, saying that, or how he liked to have his management team, saying that here's four guys, they kind of kept each other's negative tendencies in check, and the whole, what was created, you know, they were all creatively amazing, but together, the whole of that created something almost transcendent, or it was beyond, I think he said the whole was greater than the sum of the parts was kind of how he summed it up. And so I kind of threw it out there. I said, if you were really thinking about it, looking at Apple's executive team, it kind of makes you think, you know, which Beatle would each member be? And I received this feedback from Kevin.
Hey, Adam, it's Kevin Crossman. I just wanted to follow up with you on the Beatles as the Apple board or executives. So, you know, John Lennon has to be Steve Jobs, the leader, the, you know, the artistic person, the socially conscious person with high standards. For sure, he's John. Paul, got to be Tim Cook, the business-minded Beatle, the one who was always interested in trying to play nice with everyone and get things done. The quiet Beatle has to be Jonathan Ive, you know, the artistic genius, the quiet, and the, you know, shunning the spotlight, but very, very competent. And Ringo, humor, comic relief, also very talented as well. Social. Anyway, that's my thought. Keep up the great work on the MacCast. Bye.
Hey, Kevin, I think by the quiet Beatle, I'm assuming you mean George Harrison. And, you know, it's funny because as you were saying that, and I received feedback from some other people, and I think all of us kind of come to the same conclusion, and that really is kind of how it maps out. And when you start analyzing that way, especially against the comments that Steve made, it almost seems like it was like deliberate, like he found people that kind of matched up with the Beatles. And I know that's not really the case. Another thing I want to point out in this section is if you listen to the MacCast on an iPod, an iPhone, or in iTunes, and you're using the AAC version, so the one that you get through subscribing via iTunes, Peter Weiss sent me an image of the Apple executives as the Beatles, kind of a mashup of that. And I used that for the album art in this section, so you probably saw that going by. And I just wanted to give Peter credit for that and thank Kevin for his audio feedback. And then I have one more bit of follow-up from the last MacCast. So we had an email from a listener who uses Dropbox, uses iOS devices like a lot of us do because so many of them have Dropbox integration, but was noting that there are several applications where you're kind of locked to a specific folder. So the way it works is when you set up the Dropbox integration, it creates a folder inside your Dropbox, and if you want to work with files within that application, you are kind of stuck in that one folder. You have to save to that folder, and you have to read files and information out of that folder. And he was looking for some sort of way to actually move that folder's location within the Dropbox on his Mac. And I didn't really have a great solution, kind of made some workaround recommendations. Well, Owen sent some feedback and he suggested using symbolic links, which is actually, I think, a really good solution or potential solution to this problem. You'll have to play around with it to see if it works in all instances. It certainly works with Dropbox. And for those of you who don't know what a symbolic link is, you can kind of think of it like an alias, except it's different than the alias you would create within the Finder in Mac OS X. So if you just do a standard alias in Mac OS X, it's really just a pointer to the actual location where the file or the folder that you created for the alias is. And OS X can understand that, but applications like Dropbox, or more importantly, the Unix underpinnings of Mac OS X, it sees that alias as an actual file, like its own file, not the original thing. Symbolic links work differently in the fact that to the operating system, a symbolic link will look exactly like the original item, meaning that if you create a symbolic link that's a folder to any application accessing that, and I would assume this would include iOS applications that are accessing a symbolic link inside your Dropbox folder, they're going to see that and not be able to distinguish it from the actual thing. So in the case of it being a folder, by saving it into the symbolic link, it will actually save it right to whatever location that points to. So this should be able to solve the problem, because what you could do is create your folder anywhere within the operating system or deeper down inside your Dropbox folder, and then create a symbolic link at the same level and with the same name that your iOS application would expect to be saving into. And it's not going to be able to tell the difference. It's going to save to it just fine, and then it'll end up in the appropriate location within your Mac. Now, to create a symbolic link, you typically in Mac OS X have to use the terminal. You have to run a command line. It's the ln command with the -s option. I will have the command in the show notes in maccast.com, or you can look it up. I also covered symbolic links in episode 36 of the MacCast Members Program. So I'm giving you a really brief overview here if you'd like to go into some more details about how symbolic links work and why they work and stuff like that. You can check out that episode. There's also applications that'll allow you to create symbolic links, and you can find a lot of those by just doing a simple Google search. So thanks, Owen, for passing that information along, and it's definitely worth trying out. I think it should work in most cases. And I guess since we're talking about the terminal and symbolic links and command lines and stuff like that, we probably should talk about Unix, the other Mac OS X. And the reason this came up is because Phil sent me an email, and he was looking to expand his knowledge about the realm of Linux and wanted to know what the best or easiest way to install a version of Linux on Mac OS X was. And this got me thinking that, you know, first, depending on what you're wanting to do, if you're just wanting to learn command lines and you're wanting to learn syntax for Linux and Unix, they're kind of brothers, I guess you could think of them. I mean, very similar in terms of commands and shells and options and things like that. I mean, there's all kinds of different variants, of course, but they all kind of are cut from the same cloth. And in the case of Mac OS X, it does have Unix under the hood. It uses a free BSD foundation. It's actually open sourced by Apple. It's called Darwin. So you can get this, the command line open source version of Mac OS X, if you want to play around with that. But you have it built into, in essence, built into Mac OS X or Apple's, you know, variant on it. Apple obviously layers a lot of their own stuff on top of it, including the entire graphic user interface, which is not part of Darwin. But you can launch the terminal. If you just go into Applications Utilities, launch the terminal, there it is, Unix in all its glory. And we can, once again, and I say Unix very openly, it's Apple's variant of Unix, right? And they use the bash shell by default, but you can actually go in and figure out how to change that. So that would be a place to start. If you just want to play around with Unix commands and stuff like that, you don't need to install any additional software. You can start playing with it just by opening up and launching the terminal. Another potential option, if you do want to install something like Ubuntu or Mint or one of these other variants of Linux, Fedora is a common one a lot of people like to play around with. Red Hat, that sort of thing. You could set up a dual boot and have two partitions or use an external drive, a external USB drive. You could put it on a USB stick, install a variant of Linux, and you can boot from that. There are a lot of instructions online if you Google around for them. I found some pretty good instructions on scottlinux.com. Had a couple different tutorials for doing it. I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. The only thing about this is, especially if you're going with a partition and you're trying to like live partition your Mac drive, in other words, you're not starting with a clean, fresh install that you've, you know, partitioned the drive up front before you installed Mac OS X, you want to be careful because a wrong step in one direction could hose your entire system. So make sure that you back up before you start messing around with any partitioning tools or doing that sort of thing. So setting up a dual boot situation is definitely an option. If you want to go, if you want my opinion on what I think the easiest option to go with is, and if you have an Intel Mac, I think virtualization is the way to go. So get something like Parallels or VMware Fusion or even Oracle's free VirtualBox software that used to be Sun, OracleBot Sun. It's a product called VirtualBox at virtualbox.org. That's free, or you can pay for Parallels or VMware Fusion. Currently, my favorite way to do this right now is Parallels. Parallels 7 was just released, and they actually have built-in installers for Chrome, Fedora 15, Ubuntu 11.04, and actually, with this version, you can run another instance of Lion. So you can have Lion running inside of Lion, or if you have Snow Leopard and you get Parallels 7, you can actually run Mac OS X Lion inside a virtualized instance inside of Snow Leopard. So that's cool. And if you're already running Lion and you want to set up another instance of Lion using the new Parallels, they make it super easy because you can use your recovery partition as the installer. The software will actually use the recovery partition that's already installed by Lion as the installer. So you don't even have to install your own version. It just kind of does everything for you. And it does the same thing with those Linux distributions, the Fedora or the Ubuntu, because it'll just automatically pull it down, create the create the image that it needs, and run the installer all for you, and you'll be up and running within, you know, a few minutes. As long, probably the longest part of the process is actually downloading the distribution of the operating system. So I think that's absolutely the easiest way to go. You're going to need a little bit more resources. It's going to need more RAM because you're running basically an operating system inside or right on top of your existing operating system. So it shares resources. You can configure those using the software. And both Parallels and VMware Fusion do this. The other nice thing about Parallels and VMware Fusion is both of them have these things called appliances, which are already built images of different distributions of software, of Linux, of different configurations. So they'll even have complete packages, like if you wanted to go in and set up a development environment for doing web development, they'll have virtual appliances that are already configured and set up for that. So they'll have the LAMP stack, and that's Linux, Apache, MySQL, and PHP. So your complete PHP development environment already built out and set up as a virtual machine that you can simply pull down, load into VMware or Parallels, and then start running. So you get up and running much more quickly. You just have to go in then and tweak the configurations and adjust settings and things like that. But the base install is done for you, and that's easy to do with virtualization. And you can have multiple ones. So if you want to be playing around with Ubuntu and Fedora Core and Mint Linux, you could have instances of all of those all running inside of Mac OS X already, not having to dual boot. You can switch back and forth between. So I think that's, if you're just wanting to learn, if you're just wanting to play with this stuff, if you're not doing it for production, although I have to say there are a lot of servers out there that are now using virtualized environments to run different servers and different websites. So if you've ever seen web hosting and they talk about having virtual servers, that's what they're talking about. They've built servers inside of servers using this virtualization software. And that way they can move different instances around. They can do load balancing and a lot of tweaking when they need to. And it's much more efficient and easier to manage and things like that. So you can take advantage of that on your Mac. And you can even do it for free if you want to use the VirtualBox software. So that's a couple different ways to do it. Now, as far as learning this stuff, you know, you're going to need to dive into the command line. You're going to need to learn some terminal commands. There's lots of resources out there available. iBooks from O'Reilly are great. They also have applications that you can buy. And I wanted to bring up O'Reilly specifically. There's a lot of great publishers out there. But O'Reilly has a couple books. They have OS X for Unix Geeks for Leopard, the fourth edition. And really, the Unix commands stay the same pretty much. So it's the fourth edition of the book. I guess it was put out when Leopard came out. But if you look for it on the iBook store, it's $27.99. If you look for it on the App Store as an iOS app, it's $6.99. Now, you might prefer the iBook interface, but what's cool about the O'Reilly books is that they actually provide instructions for extracting the EPUB file, what in essence is the iBook file, from the application. So you can buy the $7 app, and doing a little bit of work, you can actually pull out the EPUB file and put that into back into iTunes under iBooks. So the way you do this is you download the app, right-click on the app in iTunes, and choose Show in Finder. That's going to show you where the actual application file, it's a .api file, is within Mac OS X in the Finder. You're going to want to make a copy of that file, because we don't want to work with the original because we don't want to mess it up, but we want to make a copy of that file. I usually put it out on my desktop so it's easy to find. And then change the extension on the file name to .zip, because really the .api file is just a zip file. Once you have .zip on there, you'll be able to extract it simply by double-clicking on it. That's going to extract the application, all the files and stuff like that. Those will now show up as a folder, and you can go into that folder. You're going to look for the payload folder, and then inside that, there'll be a .app file. Control-click or right-click on the .app file and choose Show Package Contents, and then inside that, you'll find a book directory. And then what you need to do is just control-click or right-click on that book directory, compress it So there'll be an option in the dropdown that says compress three items, I think it usually is. And then that'll make a zip file, a new zip file. Take that zip file, add .epub, or change its extension from .zip to .epub. And then you now have the EPUB version of that book that you can drag into iTunes, and it will be added to your iBooks section, and now you can sync it over. And that's going to be, in essence, the same thing as the $27 iBook that you would have bought from the iBook store. So that's going to save you some money, and I wanted to point that out. Apple also has some great instructions from 10.3 Server. There's a PDF guide on their website. I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. It's in their manuals section. So that's a good resource, and it's free. If you don't mind spending a little bit of money, the folks over at Take Control Books, that's Adam Engst and the Tidbits crew, they have a Take Control series called Take Control of the Mac Command Line with Terminal. It's $10, $10 ebook, and you can find that at takecontrolbooks.com. And then one more online resource I found that's a pretty good primer to get you started with Unix. Unix Mages has an older PDF book at unixmages.com. And I would start with that. That's going to give you a good idea of just basic command line operations. So if you know nothing about command line, that's a good place to start, and you can start working with Linux and Unix. So a bunch of different options there for you. Play around with it. It's a lot of fun, and I do think that virtualization, if you're going to really dive into it and want to play around with different distributions, that's probably the easiest way to go. So I believe I already mentioned at the top of the show we were going to get a little bit nerdy on this one. I received an email from Randy, and he found an interesting, kind of annoying quirk in Lion related to Automator. So if you're an Automator user, you rely on Automator. We've talked about Automator on the show in the past. If you've never dug into it, it's something that's a lot of fun to play around with. And actually, there's some new functions in Automator and Lion that I recently found out about that I'll probably share with you on another episode of the MacCast. But you can dig in there and play around with Automator. What Randy discovered was that his Automator applications suddenly stopped working. And these are one of the options you have in Automator is once you've built a workflow, you can save it out as an application, a standalone application like a .app file. And when you double click on it, it will launch just like a normal application and run your workflow. He found that those suddenly stopped working in Lion. They would run inside Automator, so the Automator has a tool for building out your workflows. They'd run inside that application, but as a standalone app, they simply would not launch. The good news is that Randy also found a fix. So if you have Automator applications and you've upgraded to Lion and you've been noticing this, what Randy discovered was that if he killed the Automator launcher process, then his applications started working again. So I don't know if this is just a hiccup, a holdover from when you do the upgrade over top of Snow Leopard or some other problem. But to kill the process, there's a couple different ways to do it. Randy found that he had to do it from the terminal, that it did not work for him using Activity Monitor. So I'm going to describe how to do it from the terminal, and then I will also, just for completeness, describe how to do it from Activity Monitor. So if you want to use the terminal, go ahead and launch your terminal. And then when it comes up, you need to find the process ID. So every process, every application that is running on your system can have processes behind it. And there might be one, there might be multiple processes. But each one of those under the hood has a process ID number or a PID number. So in the terminal, if you simply type top, T-O-P, and hit enter, it's going to fill your screen with all of the processes that are currently running. And you want to go down that list and find the Automator launcher process and make note of its PID number. Now, to get out of top in the command line, because it'll be running and fill up your whole screen, you need to press Control C to exit it and get back out to a command prompt. When you're back out at the command prompt, then to kill the process, you simply type the command kill, K-I-L-L, space, and then the process ID number for the Automator launcher process that you noted earlier. So enter that and then hit enter, and that will kill that process using the terminal. Another way to view all of your running processes that won't require you to do the Control C to get back to a command prompt is you can use the PS command. The process command, with the options AUX. So you simply type in the terminal PS space AUX, and that is going to dump all of the currently running processes to your screen and then return you to the command prompt. Now, parsing through that, it could be pretty hard to find the specific process that you're looking for, to find that process ID. In this case, it's that automator launcher one. Luckily, Unix can help us out there as well, because we can do some filtering and we can chain commands together. And the way we put commands together in Unix is you use what's called a pipe. And if you look above your return key, there's a little straight line. It's above the backslash on that key. So if you hit shift backslash, that's going to type a pipe, and then you can type another command. So we can start with that PS command, PS space AUX, and then type a pipe. And then to do the filtering in Unix, you use what's called grep, G-R-E-P. And you type the word grep and then space and then the word that you want to filter with. And I'm making this really simple and straightforward. You can dive into this deeper. There's all kinds of complex search queries that you can do using grep. But in this case, if we just type PS space AUX space and then the pipe key and then space grep, G-R-E-P, and then the word automator, and hit enter, you'll notice that you're only going to get one result. Rather than dumping a whole screen full of stuff, you're just going to see the automator command. You actually might see two, because it's going to also find the grep command that you just ran, which would show up as a running process. And I should also note that if you're actually following along with me and you're typing in this command, and you don't have an automator application running, you might not get any result, or you might only get the grep result when you run this command, because an automator application does need to be running for this automator launcher process to exist in your process list. So if you get that result, that is why. And that's what kind of puzzled me, or got me thinking more about what Randy was saying in his email, because there should be, if you don't want to use the command line, an easier way to see the running processes in your Mac is to use the activity monitor that is built into your utilities folder. So if you go into Applications, Utilities, and you launch Activity Monitor, you basically get a graphic view of the top command that we just talked about. So rather than having to use the terminal, you can get this nice user interface view. And Randy said it wasn't showing up for him in there, but that might be due to the filtering that is in Activity Monitor. So up in the upper right-hand corner, there's a drop-down list. And that drop-down list, you can filter which processes you're viewing, be it system processes or something called My Processes, which is just going to be the processes that are running under your user account. So you could be filtered on the wrong section. What I typically like to do is make sure that it's either showing My Processes or All Processes, because sometimes applications might not be running under your account. They might be running under another account within your system. So change that to All Processes, and then you can use the search filter to find the specific process that you're looking for. So if you simply start to type automator into that filter, it's going to filter down and only show you processes that have the word automator in its name. And then you'll notice there's a bunch of columns. You can sort on those columns. The first column has that process ID number. So you could note it there, and you could go back to the terminal and do the kill command using the process ID number. But in Activity Monitor, it's even easier, because you can simply select the process from the list. And then up in the upper left-hand corner of the window in the toolbar, you'll notice there's an option that says quit process. If you click that, it's a little stop sign, that will kill that process that's running on your system. So that is where I would start doing this if you don't want to dive into terminal commands. But I figured, since we are kind of covering Unix and terminal commands on this episode, I'd share both ways of doing this with you. The other thing I probably should mention, you've probably seen, we're diving a little deep here on some pretty geeky stuff, and you'll notice there's a lot of processes running in this list. You don't want to just start going through and killing random processes. This is really a tip and a trick for when you're having a specific problem with a specific application, and you know the process that you may need to reset or kill off or stop to get back up and running. If you just start going through and killing off processes, you could lock up an application, you could lock up your system. Not a huge deal. You'll just have to reboot and probably restart, and the processes that you're operating system needs will launch back up. So if you've killed some sort of critical system process, but it can be inconvenient and not a lot of fun. So you don't want to just be messing around in here. These are power user tools and for accomplishing specific tasks. Now, some of you might be kind of wondering, well, if just resetting your system kind of resets these system processes and kills off any extraneous ones, why not just do a simple reboot? And Randy noted in his email to me that he had tried doing a restart and that didn't seem to fix his issue. Now, he did point out that there's a feature in Lion that when you restart your operating system or when you choose the restart command, that it now automatically tries to restart all of the applications and things that you already had open. So probably what was going on is this Automator application was sitting there running in the background. I don't know if it was locked up or what was going on. So when he did the restart and it restored everything, it probably launched that application again and continued to cause his problem. When you do a restart in Lion, there is a checkbox now that says that you need to uncheck to tell it to not restore your applications. So unchecking that probably would have fixed the issue in Randy's case. And it could have also been that he had a Automator application that was set to launch on startup. So either in his startup items or something like that, that maybe he forgot about, and that was conflicting with other Automator applications. And so killing off the process would kill that application and allow you to start running those apps again. So you're gonna have to do a little bit of playing around, Randy, I think, to figure out exactly why you were having this problem in your case. But I wanted to point that out too, because I don't think this was a Lion issue. It seemed like a Lion issue, but I think it was more related to maybe an older Automator application that you have running on your system that's causing some sort of conflict. And of course, killing the process or just killing that application would fix things up for you. So I hope that helps explain things a little bit. And thanks for giving us an opportunity to kind of dive into Automator a little bit and into processes in Mac OS X. The last thing I want to talk to you about today is something that's built into Mac OS X. It's been in there for a while, and it's one of those integrated technologies that I've absolutely come to rely on, and I often don't even think about anymore because it's just something that's there and I use constantly. And I'm talking about Quick Look. So when I'm browsing in the Finder, my thumb is like constantly on the space bar, a little trigger finger, ready at a moment's notice to click and get a preview of whatever I'm looking for in the Finder. So if it's an image file, I might need to just get a preview without having to launch Preview or Photoshop or some other application. Same thing with a lot of my documents, Word documents, Pages documents, things like that. I can hit Quick Look, pop it up. It's great for viewing folders worth of images. So I use kind of the slideshow feature a lot. If I'm doing web development and I want to take a look at a bunch of buttons and I can't remember specifically what's that one variant of that button that I saved off, what's the file name for that? I can just select a whole grouping of items, hit the space bar, and just start flipping through them in the Quick Look mode. So it's one of those things that I really rely on, but out of the box, not every application is supported. So Apple has support for a lot of common file types, you know, PNG, JPEGs, almost all your image files. But for example, they don't support EPS. Or another one that they don't support is looking at folders in Quick Look, or looking more specifically, in my case, one that I like to be able to preview is archive files, zip files. You know, what's inside that zip file without actually having to extract and completely open that thing. Luckily, Apple thought about this and they built Quick Look in a way that developers, for one, can add Quick Look support to their application. So they can make it sort of Quick Look aware, their documents Quick Look aware, so that you can get those previews in the Finder without having to launch the application. Apple also made a plugin architecture for Quick Look so that anyone can actually build a Quick Look plugin and add support for a specific file format. There's a development kit available through Apple's developer program, and you can build your own Quick Look plugins. So in my case, there were two that I use and have added to my system. You can do a quick Google search for these, but I also have links to them in the show notes at maccast.com. And I'll also have a link to a directory site that I found that lists a number of different Quick Look plugins. That's at qlplugins.com. And you can browse through the list and see if there's ones that you might not be able to take advantage of. But my favorites are from a developer who goes by XDD. And the two are called Archive, and that's the one for quick-looking zip files. And the other one is simply called Folder. And I think he's out of Japan, so the site's in Japanese, but you can see the links for the Quick Look plugins. It's pretty obvious which one's which. Unfortunately, they don't seem to work anymore in Lion, and that's what I noted this week as I was prepping for the show. I tried to Quick Look a zip file, and it wasn't working. And so I'm going to have to find updated ones for the Folder application, but luckily I did find one for quick-looking zip files, and it's called Better Zip Quick Look Generator at macitbetter.com. These are the developers who make Better Zip, which is a really kind of nice unzipping application too. If you want something a little more advanced or beyond what is built into Mac OS X, you might check that out. But that one did work. I installed it, the only thing about that one was that in OS X Lion, Apple kind of changed the design of Quick Look. They used to have this sort of dark theme, and now it's a light white theme. So it really didn't match. Luckily, the Better Zip Quick Look Generator has been reskinned by another developer, Farfanoid, over at DeviantArt. So I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com too. Pulled that down, and so now I have a really nice Quick Look for zip files that matches my Lion theme. So how Quick Look plugins get installed, it's really just a simple file. So you'll download usually an archive, unzip it, and inside that you'll find a QL generator file or a .ql generator file. You just take that file and you copy it into your home folder, the library folder, inside the Quick Look folder. And if you don't have a Quick Look folder, you can just go ahead and create it. You just need to capitalize the Q and the L. It's all one word, Quick Look, with a capital Q and a capital L. That's the folder name. You dump this QL generator file inside that, and then that's all you really need to do to install the Quick Look plugins. I need to point out, I guess, at this point, too, that in OS X Lion, your library folder inside your home folder is not visible by default. I think we've mentioned this before, but in order to get to that folder, you may need to go in the Finder up to your Go menu, hold down the Option key, and then you'll notice that the library folder will then be listed in the drop-down list. You can select it, and then you can create this Quick Look folder or find the Quick Look folder inside your library folder. But once you've done that and you've got the plugin in there, it's installed. Now, it might not be active right away. The easiest way to get it activated is either to restart your Mac or simply log out and log back in. There are a couple other methods, although they didn't work for me. You could use the command line. You could launch the terminal application again and type the command qlmanage space dash r, which I believe is the option for reset. Hit enter, and that should reset your Quick Look daemon. I tried that. It didn't work in my case in Lion. It might work in older versions of the operating system. You could also try restarting the Finder. The way you do that is if you right-click on the Finder icon while you're holding down the Option key, you'll see a relaunch option. That's also Command Option and click on the Finder icon, and you might be able to relaunch the Finder, and that might reset it. Again, that did not work for me. The only thing that worked for me without doing a reset or a login and log back out was to actually go into the activity monitor and quit the Quick Look D32 process. When I did that, I was able to get my Quick Look plugins up and running without having to actually log in, log back out. But, you know, I think just reset, log in, log out. That's a much easier process. And then your new Quick Look plugins should be up and running. Like I said, it looks like some of the older Quick Look plugins that haven't been updated recently might not be Lion compatible, so your results may vary. If you go to these websites and you're playing around with Quick Look plugins, you might have to contact the developer, find out if there is an updated version. And if anybody knows of a Quick Look plugin for folders that does work in Lion, please let me know, because I'm looking for one now. But that'll help extend Quick Look and open up maybe some more applications and file formats to Quick Look options if you're interested in that sort of thing. So that's going to do it for today. Before I leave you, I want to thank all of my show sponsors, Furonix, makers of Deep Freeze. You can check out their software and get more information over at furonix.com. Circus Ponies Notebook is a great application. You should check it out. You can get a free trial and more information over at circusponies.com. Smile, they make text expander, PDF pen, disk label. Get information details as well as free trials over at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle, if you need cash for your old electronics, check out Gazelle at gazelle.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. A big thank you to you for your support, for staying subscribed. If you'd like to become a MacCast member and further support the show, you can get information on that. It's a couple bucks a month. You get some extra content and you help support the MacCast. You can find details over at member.maccast.com. You can also support the show by simply giving your feedback, your comments, your questions. I love hearing from you. There's a couple different ways you can do that. You can send me email. You can also attach audio files. Audio comments are very welcome. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com, or you can call in on the listener hotline, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. There's a voicemail there. Just leave your message. And if you could leave your email address, that's greatly appreciated, just in case I need to follow up with you or have any additional questions. You can also use Skype. The Skype address is the MacCast, and there's voicemail there. And don't forget, if you heard the last episode of the MacCast, the one where I asked a bunch of people, why are you an Apple user? I am looking for your feedback on why you're an Apple user, and we're going to put those together in a special episode of the MacCast, kind of a follow-up to that last episode. I do need to point out, bunch of people have left great comments. I have some good content already. I'm still looking for some more. If you leave a voicemail using the voicemail line, there is a 3-minute limit. That's because it's a Google Voice number, and it's just a restriction that Google applies. So if you can't get your comment in under 3 minutes, which I know can be difficult, I asked for about 3 to 5 minutes. Longer than 5 minutes is going to be a little bit too long to be in the show. Just be aware that there is that restriction. You might have to either do 2 recordings and I can stitch those together, or just use GarageBand or QuickTime to do your recording and then just send me the audio file. Any audio format's fine. I can deal with it. Also, a great way to do it is to use the built-in recorder that's on your iOS device, either your iPhone or iPod Touch, and you can just email that directly to me and send those to maccast@gmail.com. If you need show notes, links to anything I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum. That's at forum.maccast.com. And if you want to follow me online between shows, I'm on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, or on Facebook, facebook.com/themaccast. And I'll watch out for you there. And until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.